and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 166. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And welcome to this week's show. Now, this week is actually a pretty big week for us because, here in the UK at least, this weekend, clocks go forward. And that means summertime is here. Now, summer's all, it's a lovely time of year, but a very busy one for us normally.
Yeah, and you kind of don't notice it nowadays because all your clocks automatically change, don't they?
When
you
had to
wind them before, yeah.
But, one in my car and the oven, I think they're the only two in the house.
But summer's really crazy for us because we're doing all the gaming events, so this is going to be a fantastic one. And the first one's going to be Play Expo in Manchester.
Yeah, this is going to be a massive one as well. I mean, the thing about it is, I mean, there's lots of gaming shows in the UK, but this one is so focused on retro. And we go to them all and we do our own stage at Play Expo. So essentially, if you love this podcast and you want to see us do it live, and we're joined by legends on stage, and we have a lot of other people helping us out. Paul Drury from Retro Gamer Magazine is going to be there, and he's going to be doing the talk with Matthew Smith.
Oh, yeah. So when I was a kid, we actually did an event called Screenplay in Nottingham, and that was one of the first time Matthew Smith kind of came out of obscurity because he'd gone missing for a while. There was even a website, where is Matthew Smith? And now he's basically coming back and he's going to do a wonderful talk with Paul on the stage, and we're going to try and get that on the show as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
So if you want to come along, we're going to be there. I mean, essentially, walking to Play Expo, it is all your childhood dreams in one place. The guys who made your favourite games, trading areas, machines that you can play on. So if you want to get tickets for it, it's going to be happening in Manchester, right in the heart of Manchester, a great new exhibition place that we've got. And you can book tickets through our website at theretrohour.com, happening on the weekend of the 4th and 5th of May. It's got all so manic leading up to it as well. At the end of the weekend, we just collapsed, don't we?
Yeah.
But it's so much fun. Now, before we get into this week's show, we've got some really good stuff that we're going to talk about. I love this prototype ZX Spectrum.
Oh, gosh, yeah. There's some really exciting news this week, and they've finally done it. They've finally made a Mega Drive that's decent.
Fine, at long last. How long have we been crying out for one of those? So if you want to find out all of this week's news stories, of course, we'll talk about them in just a minute, and we link them up on our website at theretrohour.com. Now, the reason that we can come in and keep you up to speed on what's happening in the world of retro every week and bring you amazing guests. We need to talk about this week's guests in just a minute. But it's thanks to you. Now, this show, okay, we do have sponsors on the show quite regularly, but really the main way that we are supported is thanks to listener donations. That is the one thing that keeps us, you know, regularly funded. We can afford to come and do this podcast, all our hosting services, everything's paid for. You know, it means Ravi and I don't have to pay for it all out of our own pocket. So it honestly, it makes such a difference. And for making a donation of any amount, it all goes back into the pot and keeps this podcast going. You will find your place in the very prestigious Retro Hour Hall of Fame. And you'll get a mention on a future episode. Just like this week, John Matanara,
Stuart Brand,
Matt Hill,
and John Piper,
who all find their place in the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. And you can do the same by heading onto our website at theretrohour.com. Now, what a guest we've got this week.
Yeah, we've got a fantastic guest this week. And we kind of had John Robertson on last week, who was in Video Game Nation. Well, we've got one of his colleagues, and that's Steve McNeil. Now, Steve McNeil went on after Video Game Nation to Edinburgh Festival, where he got a lot of comedians drunk on stage and they all played video games.
The best way to play games.
Yeah, and then that somehow ended up on television and became Go 8-Bit. So we're going to talk all about that. Steve's got a podcast as well. He's got a book coming out, loads of interesting stuff in this. He even did lectures for the Royal Institute, Christmas lectures.
Yeah, mad. Which is crazy, isn't it? I mean, Go 8-Bit was a show, it ran for three series here in the UK.
On Dave.
Yeah, that on Dave it was, yeah. And it was, I mean, it was a show that kind of, it wasn't just 8-bit games. I mean, there's a bit of a pun in the name, but there was a lot of retro gaming in there as well. And it was really,
it's a panel show, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it was a panel show with video games featured in it. And the thing about it is, I mean, you don't really get, especially retro games, very much on mainstream TV anymore.
No, totally. And it's kind of like they're celebrities that mention them.
Yeah.
So as Steve says, you know, Jonathan Ross is a big fan, Dara O'Brien,
Ian Lee is, isn't he?
Ian Lee.
Charlie Brooker.
Charlie Brooker, yeah. They're all out there, but he just managed to get them together.
All these closet geeks got them all together on stage. So I know a lot of our audience will have loved Go 8-Bit, and you know, it's good to get the inside story. Steve McNeil is going to be our special guest on the Retro Hour podcast in around 15 minutes from now. Now, let's take a moment to give a big up to a really good supporter of the Retro Hour podcast. You know, we're big fans of The Economist anyway. It's always such a good read as well. And they've really supported this show for a couple of months now as well. You know, we really appreciate The Economist's support. And actually, we've got a little offer for you as well, because if you'd like to get a free print copy of The Economist, we'd love you to take up this offer. Now, the thing about The Economist is, I mean, from the title, it's been going a hell of a long time. Over 170 years. So very well established. And these days, I mean, you know, like anything, it kind of changes with time. It's not just about the economy and finance anymore. It covers stuff like technology, science, arts, video games as well. I was reading this really interesting article they did about this guy from Princeton University, and he was doing kind of the artificial intelligence behind self-driving cars.
Okay, yeah.
And you think how much work has to go into that? Because, I mean, that is like literally life or death.
Yeah, isn't it? And the calculations and the angles and just the different kind of things that can happen.
Especially teaching the car when to stop at stop signs and that kind of thing. So to teach a computer, you've got to think, I mean, he needs to teach it what old signs look like, new ones, clean ones, dirty ones, ones that might be covered by lorries or buildings or the shade on them. And you think if you want to do that through photo libraries or going out and doing it yourself, it's a lot of work. Turns out he actually used Grand Theft Auto 5 to teach these self-driving cars. And there's an article all about it in The Economist.
What was he using then, AI or something?
Yeah, to teach the AI. He was actually, this game was like playing Grand Theft Auto 5.
That's interesting, because we covered DeepMind, which was using Atari 2600 games to actually train itself. And they had no manuals, no instructions, and the machine actually created an algorithm which was much better than human players.
Yeah, it's Google's supercomputer, isn't it?
DeepMind.
It's crazy how video games can train AI, though, because you think, I mean, a lot of it, you know, hand-to-eye coordination and problem-solving, it's, yeah, I mean, you know, you think back to, like, war games when it played tic-tac-toe on the screen and stuff, you know. It's been a big part of AI for a long time, so that's the kind of thing you can read about in The Economist, and they teach you what's going on in the world around you, and, you know, in this day and age, facts matter more than ever. So if you'd like to get your own free copy of The Economist, we've got a little offer for you. You'll get one in the post, free through your door. All you have to do is text the word retro and send that to 78070. So if you want to get your free print copy of The Economist, text the word retro and send that to 78070. You'll get your copy through the mail and you'll be really helping out the Retro Hour podcast. Thanks to The Economist, the smart guide to the forces changing your world. So let's talk about this new Mega Drive clone. Is there finally a modern Mega Drive clone that's worth our money?
Yes, there is. So before we had the At Games consoles and all these rubbish ones.
We talked about that.
Yeah, which used to have awful quality noise and everything. Well, this is the genuine stuff. This is like absolutely amazing. Made by Analog.
So Okay.
You heard of Analog NT before, and that was a really accurate recreation of the Nintendo console. So they also had a Famicom one as well, which was just absolutely awesome, or SNES. And now they've released a Mega Drive one, so it's called the Mega SG. How much do you think this machine would kind of be?
Well, looking at it, I mean, looking at the pictures, I haven't seen it in person, but it looks like it's a quality product. And I remember even like the, you know, the At Games ones, they were like $80 anyway.
Yeah.
And if you're talking about stuff like, you know, if it's got real proper HDMI, is it like 60 frames a second HDMI output?
Yeah, 1080p. Yeah. It's really nice. It's got compatibility with all of the games, including the ones with the special chips that you had to put in. But also it has Mega CD compatibility. So you can put it on the Mega CD expansion. It has this nice little kind of mat that you can put on.
Like the original.
Yeah.
That's pretty sexy.
But of course it's really tiny. Another really amazing function of this is that it has these new controllers. And these controllers look exactly like the kind of old school Mega Drive style.
It's a six-button style, isn't it?
Six-button, but they have absolutely no lag at all on them.
Yeah.
And they're using the 2.4G wireless.
Right, okay.
So, you know, I was watching Modern Vintage Gamers video and he was saying these would be good in the Amiga CD32 or any of these old consoles. You could put these wireless pads in and no longer have cables going everywhere.
Right, I'm looking at this now because it plugs into the old D-sub connector, doesn't it? It's got that on the front. Wow, okay. So you could use that technically with anything.
Yep.
Got that connector, that's
but
really cool.
But also, it has adapters.
Right.
So the Analog does the Sega Mark III, if you get the adapter, the Game Gear, Sega My Card. I've never even heard of my card.
Right.
The SG-1000.
Yeah, Master System.
And the SC-3000 as well. So it seems like there's compatibility for everything.
Which is rare
on a clone. Apart from the 32X.
Well, reading the comments here, apparently they're working on that.
Really?
So, yeah, that could be something that's coming.
Yeah, because it might have been harder to implement that and stuff because it's total different hardware again, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to wire uploads and stuff. You know,
it's a FPGA as well, so really it looks fast.
So, I mean, even the fact that... Cause, I mean, I've got, like, recently bought a 4K 65-inch Sony TV,
yeah.
Ultra HD, all that stuff. Hasn't got a SCART connector, no composite video, nothing like that. So hooking my old systems up to it, unless you want to go down, like, the FrameMeister kind of route, which I know you've got one of those.
But then the FrameMeister has one frame of lag.
Right, okay. This, which can affect a lot.
Yeah, this doesn't even have that.
And how much is a FrameMeister?
Oh, quite a bit. Yeah,
like, yeah, totally yeah, $200.
Yeah. And there's the OSSC, which is the kind of, it doubles the image rather than scales it. But that's a little bit cheaper, but it's still quite pricey.
So, I mean, by the time you've got an original system and one of those, I imagine this at, like, what is it, about $200?
Yeah.
It's not a cheap thing, but I think they've done it right. So if you want a modern Mega Drive system, it's going to be worth the money.
And the sound is beautiful as well. This is the thing. The sound is really good. And what you can do is you can turn the low-pass filter off. You can do loads of filtering effects on top of the videos as well.
Oh, nice.
So you can add your scan lines. You can even remove all the pixels if you want to do that. How dare you?
Ravi's eyeing this thing up for music DJ.
I really am.
Analyze that sound already. So it looks really good. I think they've done a nice job of the case and everything as well. It looks beautiful, I think.
Yeah, yeah. They've got three colours. So yep. It's four colours, actually. It's for all the different regions. So you've got like a USA, EU, a Japanese one, and just a white one.
I want the purple one, like, you know, the little purple, a bit like the Japanese one. That was always my favourite Mega Drive. So I want to find out more about that. It looks awesome, this thing, actually, I've got to say. It's good when someone actually does, like, a, you know, kind of a clone of an old system that's worth buying. So there's been so many bad attempts at the Mega Drive. So if you want to find out more about the Mega SG, I'll put a link to that and all of the rest of this week's stories in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, let's talk about this really cool Rare Sinclair ZX Spectrum prototype. Now, this is in the Centre for Computing History in Cambridge. And they've done this video kind of showing, this is from 1981.
Wow.
This thing reminds me of, do you remember at school when you built like radios?
Yeah, stuff yeah. Like that. It was all like copper wrapped around.
Wire wrapped and stuff. Yeah, that's what I was thinking for. But yeah, it looks handmade, which I imagine it is. But this is, it's a fully functional 16K spectrum.
And it looks in incredible condition, considering how old it is. You know, they were looking at it and they were saying, the only thing that's missing is a couple of the stickers, because it hasn't got that rubberized keyboard yet.
Yeah.
It's got a real clicky-clacky keyboard.
Which is a positive, actually.
Yeah. but then all the markings on each key are the exact same ones that they had on the rubber ones.
But with stickers.
Yeah.
So these stickers have been on there for like nearly 40 years, and a lot of them still survived. It looks in really good condition. It's got like ceramic chips in there as well that have been, you know, imagine like they're reprogrammable chips that are in there. It's incredible how finished this looks. And apparently it'll run, you know, a lot of the Spectrum software and everything.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful video of it on Hackaday as well. Yeah. And on their YouTube channel that you can check out if you're really interested in that.
You just know every Spectrum owner is going to be looking at that thinking, oh, I'd love to play Daley Thompson on that keyboard instead of the rubber key thing. So yeah, if you want to find out that, I'll put the video in as well. It's worth looking at our show notes. Now, recently, Retro Gamer magazine, which is a magazine I pick up most months, really good read. They did a feature last month all about the Bitmap Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
And well, obviously, we've had, you know,
legendary company.
Mike Montgomery's been on the show before. We've covered all their games and stuff in the past. And one of my all-time favourite games was Gods. I used to love Gods back in the
Gods
day.
Gods was awesome. Speedball 2 and Gods. I think the soundtracks and just the graphics were just wow. All that shiny metal, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very cyberpunk, their games, weren't they? It was, you know, I was a huge fan of them back on the Amiga, and the Atari ST obviously got a lot of those games too. And now, Gods has got an HD remake. Now, this was also something that was in Retro Gamer last month. They kind of did like a couple of page feature. I looked at that and I thought, you know, we should get these guys on because it looks really cool. So let's go over to Nils and Michael from Robot Riot, who are the guys behind this Gods HD upgrade. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Hello, thanks.
Now, you are behind this new remake of Gods. I mean, were you both like big fans of the original? What kind of memories have you got of the original Gods?
Yeah, actually, it was one of the my favorite games on my Atari ST. I played it back then in the 90s, obviously, and really liked that game. So a couple of years later, or actually 15 years later, so to say, we had the opportunity to get this license, and it was a no-brainer for me to pursue that opportunity. So that was how the whole project started.
So when you're continuing Gods, you're kind of improving on some legendary stuff that was there anyway. Like, the sound was amazing in Gods and the graphics. So how have you guys kind of remastered it and improved it?
Well, for me, obviously, the decision was to, in terms of graphics, to do something new, because the original pixel graphics were already so great that I thought it would be very difficult to top that. So we thought making it, give it a totally new look with 3D graphics and light and shadow and stuff like that. But the original was also a little bit enhanced, as it's part of the remastered version, so you can play the original Amiga graphics version. The original had only 17 FPS on a European machine, because it was updated every third frame, and that was something we approved in the new version, so that you have a smooth 60 FPS throughout the whole game. But actually, that's pretty much it. So the whole gameplay and pace is still intact.
Well, one thing I loved about the original game was, you know, that amazing music that, you know, stuck in everyone's head who played the original game. And Michael, you've done the audio for the new version of the game. Then what did you kind of look at, and how inspired were you by the original?
Yeah, I mean, the original music on the Amiga, I think it was one of the most popular pieces of game music ever made. So I knew replacing this music would be some kind of crime. So we tried our best to get the license of the original piece, but unfortunately we didn't get it. So we tried about, I think, more than a year to get a license. But yeah, we didn't get it. So I knew whatever we will do, there will be fans that would not like whatever new piece would come in there. We were discussing whether should we just leave it out or do something completely different. But in the end, we decided to make something similar to the original piece. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is how it ended up. And by the way, in the first step, we actually made a cover version of the original that can be heard on SoundCloud. I can send you a link. So we made something similar, and I guess most of the fans actually liked what we did. And in the original Amiga version, there was no music in the levels. And I was always wondering why there's no music in it, because the sound effects were great and the graphics were perfect. So it was clear for me that we definitely needed some new music for the levels. As I didn't play the Atari version in these days, I didn't even know that there was music on the Atari ST. So I made something completely different, and I went for some shopping and bought some instruments that were related to Greek culture. And yeah, we started up, and that's what you hear right now.
Well, I mean, updating such a beloved game, I mean, it's always going to be, I imagine, quite a scary thing to do, because, you know, people are that into the original, it's steeped in nostalgia, and, you know, it's really important to do it right. I mean, what's kind of the reaction been like then from people that have played the game so far?
Yeah, actually, when we started the project, and I started doing this dev blog on Facebook quite early on, and you know, not always the people get this, that this is an evolving process. So when you share the first graphics, and there was quite a lot of negative feedback because it was just not finished. Mm-hmm. But I decided to talk about all the problems we had and the ideas we were discussing and stuff like that. Actually, that's what DevBlog is all about. So, but that changed at some point. So when we reached a final look of the game, the feedback of the fans actually turned quite positive. And since the game is out, when you look at, for example, the Xbox rating, it's quite good. So the people actually who care about the game really like what they got.
And I'm seeing it's available, as you said, for the Xbox, Steam as well, with full kind of Steam controller support and Steam Cloud, so you can have your online cloud saving. Right. What other platforms are you aiming for?
Right now, as I said, it's a release is imminent for PS4 and Switch. It's on March 29. That's already fixed. So all the certification is done, and we're actually doing a bit of promotion right now, and the game is going to be live. end of the month. And apart from that, we are probably going to release a mobile version as well, but this is probably something towards the end of the year.
That's, I think the Switch is such a platform that, you know, retro games feel at home on as well.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to play it on there. Well, guys, listen, it's been amazing catching up with you. If people do want to get hold of the remastered version of Gods for the 21st century, we'll put a link in our show notes to where people can buy it from. And, you know, it's great to see one of our favourite childhood games getting a bit of love and updated. So keep up the good work, guys. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Now, before we get into our interview this week with Steve McNeil, let's talk about a classic first-person shooter. Do you remember in the mid-90s, so many FPSs came along after, like, Doom and Quake?
Yeah.
I remember stuff like, I used to look like Heretic and Hexen. They were great games as well. And Blood, that was a game that came out in 1997.
Yeah, so there was a set of games that came out on Ken Silverman's engine, which was called just the Build Engine at the end, which was what Duke Nukem 3D was based on. And that was, do you remember Redneck Rampage?
Yeah.
That was all, you go around and killing chickens and stuff. And then they had a Shadow Warrior as well, and Blood was one of them. Now, Atari actually talking about redoing Blood at the moment.
Right.
Which is pretty cool, which is going to be a remake. But they're doing it with this company called Night Dive. Now, I was just looking at Night Dive stuff, and this is such a cool motto for a company, bringing lost and forgotten gaming treasures back from the depths.
And we like that.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that we really like. And I was looking at their projects, and they did System Shock, which is a very big popular pledge that's currently coming out. So I think that they're going to deliver on this. But the list of games that they've got under their belt, Turok 2.
Oh, wow.
All these, I guess, could be done in the future.
Are they the guys who just released that on the, so it came out the Nintendo Switch, didn't it, Turok? It got like a, there's an upgrade version on
there. Also had Seventh Guest.
Wow.
They've got The 11th Hour. There's lots of different titles here. Harvester, do you remember that one?
No.
No, but it wasn't a harvesting game. It was a farming one. But yeah, this company looks really interesting. I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a messed up game.
Yeah, so it's interesting to see that Atari are working with these guys, and let's hope that we can see more titles coming out from beneath the depths.
And I do love it when they upgrade old FPS games, because, I mean, you know, you remember when you first saw this genre of gaming? I remember the first time I played Quake. You know, it blew me away. I'd never seen anything like that before. But now they're not quite as easy on the eyes to play all these years later.
It's strange because original Duke Nukem, which was built on Ken Silverman's engine. I recommend everybody watches the history of the Build Engine, Ken Silverman's, because you can see the development of slopes, transparent walls and all of this. But actually, the original Duke Nukem, you can put 24-bit skins on there.
Okay.
And it's called Polymost, which was this like kind of shading. And you can get the original Duke Nukem up to like modern levels, high 1080p resolution.
No way.
All of this with the original engine. So I'm hoping that if they can kind of do this with Blood, they might be able to just go, oh, let's just chuck out Redneck Rampage. Let's chuck out a few others on this engine.
Well, if the engine was made to be scalable, yeah. And I mean, it does actually say here that one of the things they're promising is it's going to be have enhanced compatibility for modern Windows PCs. So hopefully that will see some improved features too. So.
Or maybe crazy mods. You never know.
Yeah. That's always the best thing about those games, wasn't it? All the third-party mods that you'd find on the internet and stuff. So yeah, if you want to find out more about that, I'll shove that and everything else we've talked about this week in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into our chat with Steve McNeil, all about Go 8-Bit and these amazing new projects he's working on, including his retro gaming book, let's give a big mention to our good friends at Beer 52. Now, Beer 52, here's some words that are going to be music to your ears, especially if you know if you live here and the weather's getting a bit warmer now and you want to spend a bit of time out in the garden. Free beer.
Oh, you know what I was doing the other night? I was DJing for my 8-bit mix, 8bitmix.com, check it out.
Plug, plug, plug.
Yeah, and there was a load of listeners in there and they're going, enjoy my Beer 52 whilst watching this mix.
Nice.
Wonderful combo.
I mean, come on, does it get any better than this? A free case of craft beer. Thanks to our good friends at Beer 52. Now, all you have to do to claim this is nip onto the website. The link is beer52.com/retro. So that's beer52.com/retro to get your free case of beer. And like we said, you know, this being the first weekend of summer, if you live, you know, in Europe or the UK, it is, you know, the perfect chance to get some extra special beers in. Now, Beer 52 are the world's most popular monthly craft beer discovery club, and they search out incredible exclusive small batch craft beers from the world's greatest breweries and bring them back to their members. So again, it's not the kind of stuff you're going to find in Morrison's down the beer aisle. You know, this is stuff that they have gone to massive lengths to try and find these for you. And at the moment, they're actually doing something really good. Citizens of Everywhere. Now, because, you know, they're saying Europe has given us so much over the years. Could be stuff like booze cruises, exotic sausages, our royal family, for example.
Bratwurst.
Exactly. But also, maybe the best thing has been the beer and breweries. You know, we love drinking, obviously, these amazing beers that we can get from Europe. And homegrown stuff as well, which is why at the moment they're searching out the best European beers. So if you want to get hold of this case, not only will you get beers from all over Europe, but also they'll include their Ferment magazine as well, which is, I mean, I've read a couple of these now. You don't realise how interesting beer is until you start flicking through this magazine.
You know, saying that, actually, whenever we go to a retro event in any kind of place in Europe, there's always a brewery, and we always have to go and see the local brewery.
I think that's the thing. Gaming and beer just go hand in hand, don't they? So if you want to get hold of a case of beer to try this out, I mean, you know, you might be a fan of dark beer or lighter beers, or maybe both, and get yourself a mixed case. All you have to do to get your first case for free, you just need to pay the £5.95 postage, and you will get 8 incredible craft beers. They're Ferment magazine and a snack included as well. Ooh. Perfect for the weekend with next day shipping. No brainer, really. No minimum commitment. Take the free case, try the beer, see what you think. If it's not for you, pause or cancel it. All you have to do to claim your case right now is head to beer52.com/retro. Right then, time to get the inside story on the amazing Go 8-Bit with this week's special guest, Steve McNeil. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is our favourite bit of the show now, where we welcome on this week's special guest, the man behind Go 8-Bit. Welcome to the show, Steve McNeil.
Thank you for having me. It's very nice to be here.
Great to have you joining us. Now, obviously, Go 8-Bit was such a big TV show, ran for 3 series on Dave, and the show that in recent years got retro gaming back onto mainstream TV. So we will talk all about that in just a minute. But I mean, just talking about you, Steve, I mean, what's kind of your gaming background? What got you into this crazy world of games?
I've never not had games. So the first console we had in our house was a Pong. It was a Adman Grandstand TV Game 2000, because I'm older than you, I'm guessing. So we had Home Pong was the first thing, and then an Amstrad CPC 464 was the first computer, and then all the way through. So it was mainly computers. It was the Atari ST, the Amiga, but also consoles from the SNES. I was always Nintendo, so from SNES onwards, I sort of had Nintendo. I've never not had games. Ever.
So it's you great. Were a kind of Nintendo fanboy, but did you also have a system that you just really desired or drooled over?
I don't know if I was a Nintendo fanboy. Nintendo was just better. It just had more colours, and it had Mario Kart on it. So there was nothing really on Sega on the Mega Drive for me. I think most of the guys that I was at school with as well, they were all Nintendo. So I never really had that affinity with Sonic or Shinobi or any of those things. I thought you'd be more annoyed when I just said Nintendo, so I can only assume you guys are all in Nintendo now.
We like to remain impartial. We have another co-host called Joe, who's like the biggest Sega fanboy ever, but he's not here today. So
oh, great, perfect. Yeah, Sega's rubbish.
No one smashed up the studio. I mean, did you watch much gaming TV when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, of course it was. I mean, Games Master was the one when I was a kid, which the original sort of slogan on the posters for Go 8-Bit when we started as a live show was Games Master drunk in a cupboard was sort of the pitch for it. So it was unashamedly paying tribute to that. And then obviously Games World as well on Sky, and all the Big Boy Barry stuff who I've been lucky enough to work with sort of since. But even the computer channel, I don't know how old you guys are, but the computer channel was another thing that was sort of this weird cable channel that was only on for like 2 hours a day, but they used to put stuff on that. And you sort it out where you could find it digitized as well, like Teletext. I know that's incredibly old, but you get the digitizer pages on Teletext and get the reviews and the tips and things. It was didn't have the luxury of the internet. So if there was anything that existed that had video games in it, you just sort of gobbled it up, because it was all you were going to get.
And there was this kind of period where video game television, you know, disappeared for a long while. I think the last thing that I remember seeing was Fun Bandits, or around that period of time, as a kind of a mainstream game show.
Yeah, it's sort of every couple of years telly has a go at it, but it's I imagine if you drew like a timeline of it, there's probably never a time when there hasn't been one or two shows on telly that are about video games, but they're often buried on the lower end channels, and they're made for pennies and peanuts. So I don't think there's been many shows other than Games Master, because even GameSword was described. I think GamesMaster was the only one really that was mainstream enough that most people were at least aware of it, even if it wasn't for them. So it's telly's never really given it the platform.
And I guess you were really reliant on it when you were a kid, because that was like your primary information source. I remember watching one called Cyberzone that was on really late at night, but I'd just stay up to watch it. And it was only was that 5 seconds of a video game clip, but you know, till 3 a.m.
How old are you guys?
Late 30s.
Oh, all right. Yeah. So we are about the same. Yeah. Fair enough. I'll stop feeling so sorry for myself then. Fine.
But yeah, I mean, I remember watching Games Master and Bad Influence as well. It used to be on ITV.
Bad Influence is one I never saw at the time. I've gone back and looked at it since, obviously, because of what I do. But Bad Influence sort of passed me by with Violet Berlin and all that. But that was another good one for sure.
So were you always kind of a performer, or did you always want to be on television?
No, I never really did any of that at school until I think I was about 15 or 16, and there was a school musical audition came up, and I just went along with a mate because he didn't want to go on his own, and then ended up getting a part in the play and sort of then got a taste of it, because if anybody's familiar with me, I've always looked like me, and that was not good in terms of meeting women. So being in a musical, all of a sudden I had a discernible skill that was attractive, and that sort of helped. So I guess I sort of clung to that like a life raft in the hopes that women might like me. So that was my beginnings of performing, was doing Guys and Dolls at school. And then I did a management degree when I went to university, sort of did amateur dramatics for years. I was 26 before I went to theatre school.
You started working at Jinx as a contributor. How did you get that role then, and how did you progress to being on the screen?
I'm trying to remember now. Jinx is a weird one, because me and Sam Pamphlon, the other guy from Go 8-Bit, the other team captain, we were a sketch comedy double act, and it's really random. We occasionally got brought in by the National Film and Television School to just like be pretend people in things, so that the camera students could learn how to focus cameras and sort of shoot stuff. And so on one occasion, I was in there doing a pretend chat show, basically. So I was one of the guests in this pretend chat show, so they could film sort of live multicam stuff. And David McClelland, who hosted Planet of the Apps on Jinx, happened to be the host for that. And he just mentioned that he worked at Jinx. And then it was just before we did the first ever Go 8-Bit live show. So it was in July 2013. And he brought everyone from Jinx along to the first ever Go 8-Bit. And then they started talking to us about maybe they'd like to make it, but Jinx had got no money, so that wasn't viable. But what they did do was obviously have all the reviews and features and things on the channel, so they couldn't afford to make Go 8-Bit, but they saw that I was a comedian that liked games of sufficient quality to allow me to start writing for them. So I began as a writer, writing features for the original version of Video Game Nation. So not the one John, Dan and Aoife were in, but the original one with Tom Deacon and I cannot remember her name, which is very bad. But there were two different hosts when that show started, Video Game Nation, which was made by Jinx. And I just wrote sort of features for them to do voiceover, was how I started.
And Video Game Nation, it was an interesting show, because that was like kind of, you know, gaming coming back on TV. I mean, that was, I remember a lot of people used to watch that I know.
For me, it's in terms of a show that doesn't condescend to the audience and actually covers games properly, for me, it's not because I'm in it. I just turn up and say stupid stuff for 2 minutes a week. But that show was great. It really deserved a better audience and a better shot, because if you were actually into games, it was, you know, it was contemporary. Everybody on it actually knew what they were talking about, and it didn't try to explain what a shoot 'em up was. I thought Video Game Nation was a great show. I was really gutted when it ended, because it's like Go 8-Bit's stupid. It's fun. I'm proud of it, but Go 8-Bit's a panel show. Video Game Nation was a proper TV show about games. It's a show. There's nothing like it now.
Well, I was going to say, it's quite interesting that you kind of had comedians and stuff there. Do you find much crossover with the world of gaming and the world of comedy?
Yeah, because like comedians only work an hour a day, so most comedians have got time to kill, and games are fun. So a lot of comedians play games. A lot of them, like Brendan Burns, who was a guy whose show I was in years and years ago, like he always takes his Xbox on tour with him and sort of takes the console and just plugs it into the hotel telly. And a lot of comics do that. Or nowadays, everybody's got a Switch. But most comedians have. Well, they've not grown up and they've got loads of time on their hands. So it's a really good crossover.
Goes hand in hand.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, Well, you've also done features for, you know, like Vice Gaming and London Economic and Time Out. How did you kind of get involved in writing then?
I asked them if they'd give me some money and they were foolish enough to say yes, so then I did it. I wish there was a better story behind that, but it was because I'd been writing the stuff for Jinx. Well, what it was really was because I worked in fitness club franchising for about 10 years while I was being an out-of-work actor and comedian and then making things like Go 8-Bit. And with the writing work at Jinx, eventually that became enough of a regular piece of work that I managed to jack in the day job and do it full time. But then as things ebbed and flowed, excuse me, with what Jinx needed of me, then I could, if I needed more money and hadn't got enough work, I'd then go, well, look, here are examples of me saying words on pages. Can you let me do that for you, please? So it was always on spec. Just if I'd got a bit of free time and I needed a bit more cash, I'd just harass everybody. And the ones that you've listed are the ones that were kind enough to give me their money. But it was entirely a cash grab, although not a lucrative one, I can assure you. I don't know if you guys have ever written for things like that, but there's not a lot of money in that. Now, everybody I've met who was in games journalism's left it, pretty much, unless they're like staff, because it pays appallingly.
So where did the idea of you two guys just kind of collaborating and getting these comedians to play games on stage, when was that formed? Was it just like one night where you were like, right, let's do this?
Yeah, I think the initial seed of the idea came from me, and I think initially I kicked it around with another comedian, a guy called Guy Kelly, who was in a sketch group called the Beatamouse, who we'd gigged a lot with, and there's lots of format shows. There are lots of like late night things like Go 8-Bit that happen in Edinburgh every year, where comedians just organise a late night thing at the weekend for fun. And I was into games, and we just sort of figured if we get comedians drunk and get them to swear at each other while they battle on Street Fighter or Mario Kart. Video games are entertaining to watch anyway, and comedians are funny. So if we slam the two together with booze at midnight, we only did it in a 50-seater room, but we figured there'd be 50 nerds in Edinburgh who'd be similarly inclined to be up at a pay to watch it. But there was no plan to do anything with it. It was purely to just make the week a bit more bearable because we'd got a silly thing to look forward to where we could just drink vodka and play Tetris. And then almost inevitably that then became far more successful than anything else we'd done.
Well, how did it kind of grow into the show then?
Well, I mean, it arrived fully formed. I mean, the first Go 8-Bit was pretty much the format as it remained up until we made the TV show. We sort of lost these sort of forfeits and the sort of ladsier elements of the show. But it was comedians come on, battle on games, and the loser gets punished. The winner scores points, and it went very well the first year. We were 2013. We were up there. Every show sold out, so we had another show. Then we had a residency in London. And that was always standing room only as well. Guy called Rob Sedgbeer, who's the guy who's the genius behind the Wi-Fi Wars thing that I'm now involved in. He was the boyfriend of a girl who was a fan of ours when we did sketch comedy, and he'd created this technology that allowed the audience to log in and play on their phones with the game. So he said, "Do you want to use this?" And we said, "Yes, we do," and sort of roped him in, and it sort of took on its own momentum. And then the guy who took it on to develop it for TV actually took it on. I think it was October we signed the deal, so it only existed for about 3 months. And he was the director of that Brendan Byrne show I'd been in 2007, and he directed me and Sam's show in 2012, and sort of we were friends, we kept in touch. And he was a big gamer too, so he managed to find us a little bit of development money to try to develop it. So it all, actually, having spent years and years trying to get sitcoms away and trying to get the sketch comedy stuff going, is when Go 8-Bit happened, it all sort of, in telly terms, happened very, very quickly.
And you know, you say kind of very, very quickly, if you think about guys kind of making a video and then just uploading it to YouTube, there's no real process or big discussions or anything like that. How long was the kind of transition from stage to television, and how long did that process take of everybody discussing stuff and getting everybody happy?
Yeah, well, we did the first preview ever of Go 8-Bit. It was the 2nd of July of 2013. I don't know why I remember that date, but I do. But it was 2nd of July 2013. So it was in the month before Edinburgh in August. The show got picked up formally for development in October of that year. And then we spent 2 and a bit years developing the show. I think in summer 2014, we filmed a live pilot at the place where Dave Gorman's show Modern Life Is Good used to be filmed. So we sort of piggybacked on all his lights and tech that he had there. So it was about a year from it being picked up to filming this pilot, and then about another year and a bit before they finally gave it the nod. And that was really when we got Dara on board that swung it. It took a long time to get telly to look at it and take it seriously, because the received wisdom in telly then and arguably still now, is that video games doesn't work on telly. And so no, every month we'd do a new show in London at the residency so that we could show it off the telly. And every month then no one would turn up. So there'd be no execs would bother to turn up. It would be sold out and it'd all go great, but no one from telly would actually show up.
It was very, weird, very isn't it?
See it? Yeah, it is. Sort of me and Sam joke about being bulletproof in terms of career longevity and success, because if we're attached to it, it will tank. regardless of quality, it's doomed if we're anywhere near it. But Go 8-Bit eventually, thankfully, did stick.
I mean, when did you first meet Darren? What got him involved next? I remember, you know, reading some stuff on like Twitter and that, people being like, you know, he's an unusual choice for a video game show. But actually, he is a gamer, isn't he, Darren?
No, he's a proper gamer. Yeah, yeah. He hosts like the BAFTA Games Awards every year. Yeah. He's a big gamer. He's got an arcade cabinet in his house. He's you know, he's doing very well. But he'd been we knew of him as a gamer. You know, there's people like him, Jonathan Ross, Charlie Brooker. There's a few high profile sort of comedy personalities in the UK who were also gamers. And Dara was the best fit, because as well as loving games, he also, obviously with Mock the Week and other shows, he's an exceptional host, particularly of panel shows. And so our producer flirted with him for ages, taking him out for dinner and trying to convince him to put his name to it, which eventually he did. The thing that got him over the line was we did a show, I think it was the last one we did, December 2015, and we had one of Rob's interactive phone games. We used to use them in Go 8-Bit, where basically you get like a secret code and you have to type it in quickly. We'd like shuffle the keypad and do tricks and mesh around. And sorry, I've just bunked my mic. And Dara was playing along sort of in the corner, being as discreet as he could be for a, you know, 7-foot man with a big hat. When he went out in the game, when he screwed it up, he leapt up and roared his disgust. And that was the moment that we knew that we got him, because he was totally invested in the mischief. He was a big champion of Rob's when we did the TV show as well, in terms of the way that we used Rob's tech. It's yeah, but yeah, we begged him to for ages, and eventually he relented. Is how we got Dara, and he was the right choice. You know, he's I know as with anybody with his profile, that for every tweet that sings his praises, there'll be another one calling him an arsehole. But that's just sort of the nature of success. But he's inarguably the best person for that job. I think he proved it in the show.
Well, when you kind of talked about this show on stage, it seemed a lot more kind of retro than it did on television. Was there like a bit of a demand for having more modern titles in there?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the live show, we could sort of do whatever we wanted and be a bit more niche with it, because we, you know, our audience was gamers, and it didn't have to have that broad appeal. Whereas I think the intention with the TV show was to try to cover all areas of gaming. But not that that's a bad thing. I think, you know, the sort of the routine we got into was that we'd start with like a proper classic retro game in round one, let the guests pick whatever they fancied for their choices, but then also, as well as having a modern game, have an indie game as well. And, you know, one of the nicest things about Go 8-Bit was that when we did have games like, say, Overcooked or What the Box or A Human Fall Flat, games like that, when they like the Gang Beasts. I mean, there's loads, but those sorts of games really, like, several developers have sort of independently told me that the impact that being on the show had on their sales, because in terms of getting visibility on a platform like Steam, it's almost impossible to break through. And not that those games I said aren't big games, but that having that level of coverage on telly was incredibly helpful in getting people to buy their games. So that was one of the positives of it, was giving a platform for those sorts of games, which nowhere else ever really looks at. Because if you have got a half-hour show on TV about games, it's going to be about Grand Theft Auto and Call of Duty, because they're the biggest ones.
Did you find any people were kind of confused about the title, you know, Go 8-Bit, expecting it all to be like, you know, really old games?
Yes. I mean, there will be one or two people listening to this who still won't have got it. It's just a crap pun. But no, with every single time the episode went out, people will point out that all the games weren't 8-Bit. And there's a level of sort of, there's a lack of self-awareness in oneself to not go, it's just a word related to games, and they've done a thing. It doesn't have to all be 8-Bit games, but there were certainly that militant subset that we've all encountered on forums on the internet who maybe take themselves a little bit too seriously.
Yeah, you got Ellie Gibson as the kind of Games Master, and she would come out with the trivia and stuff. And she got quite a lot of slack online, actually, which I think it wasn't really deserved. Do you think that's kind of part and parcel of...
Ellie Gibson is legitimately one of the best games journalists our country's ever produced, and she's also an incredibly funny woman, as proven by the awesome Scummy Mummy show that she does. Unfortunately, there is a subset of gamers that is incredibly toxic, that if they see a woman anywhere near games, they choose to be an absolutely dreadful to them. And unfortunately, Ellie... as any, you know, you look at people like Julia Hardy or Aoife Wilson or any of those guys, their notifications on Twitter are horrific for no other reason than because of their gender. It is heartbreaking. But it's also the reason that we were very, very keen on the TV show too, because Ellie wasn't involved in the live show. And we wanted to make sure we had a strong female presence within the show, not just with Ellie, but also with the guests, making sure we'd always got sort of female representation.
So it's not the kind of boys' club with
No.
Yeah. And no, really reflects but, gaming.
Indeed. But, you know, it is... those people just won't shut up or go away.
Well, in terms of guests that you did have on the show, I mean, kind of, you know, if you got a guest on who wasn't a gamer or was a gamer, I mean, how much influence did they have on the games that they were going to play, and could they kind of request a game?
Yeah, they absolutely could, and we tried to tailor it to it as much as we could. I mean, games clearances was incredibly problematic on the TV show in terms of the way that it was chosen to negotiate agreements for usage. It sort of became a noose around our neck a little bit on Go 8-Bit, so more often than not, we'd have a go at getting the game. If we couldn't, we'd sort of got the list of games that we could actually play and encourage them to find one that suited them more. But I think so sometimes we made it a bit harder for them in that regard. But also, we I've talked about this in loads of different places, but we had a real issue with lag in the studio. They never gave us monitors in the desk, and the way it worked was that, like, the gaming PCs and the kit was underneath the desks where we're sat. But then the video feed from that had to go about 400 meters out of the studio up a wall into the gallery to be mixed and then sent back to the big screen, which is what we play games on. And so, particularly with emulation of things like Chucky Egg with Susan Kalman or Gran Turismo with Zoe Lyons, like when she's just doing donuts in a tunnel, I got reasonable at correcting for that because the amount of time I spent on the studio and on the show. But, you know, all of those guests that got grief online for it obviously not being their favorite game, in inverted commas, they were all perfectly solid at them backstage in the sort of green room where we've got the toy set up. It was just we sort of set them up to fail a little bit, but
that's the thing.
Sadly that was out of my hands. I was a passionate advocate of not having lag to play games, but some of the non-gaming contingent failed to recognize the importance of that.
Yeah, God, it can make such a massive difference. I think I got like one of those, you know, the Competition Pro USB joysticks they released a couple of years ago, and there's a little problem. It introduced like maybe just a couple of millisecond lag, but I was dreadful at all these games. You know, you don't realize, but it really throws you off.
And imagine all the equipment in a TV studio as well that could create interference, and, you know, God.
Yeah, that's the nice thing about the newer projects that I'm working on, is that actually I think what we've managed to do with Go 8-Bit, it was still a good show and a lot of people liked it, but by demonstrating categorically the deficiencies in that show, people are more inclined now to listen to us when we propose better alternatives. So that's nice. So
that was my next question. Do you think that Go 8-Bit's kind of opened up the opportunity for more gaming television to arrive? And
no, it's still really hard. I'm getting close on a couple of different things, but I thought, because Go 8-Bit did very well in terms of viewing figures, especially for Dave as a channel, but it has not reassured television executives of the viability of gaming as a thing, which is even more strange now, because like when I think back to when we started doing Go 8-Bit 2013, things like Twitch and, I mean, even like YouTube gaming stuff wasn't as big a thing then. So even, you know, there isn't anybody that isn't aware of YouTubers and influencers being a thing now, I don't think. I think it's sort of entered the sort of cultural mainstream, the idea of people existing online and creating content. Yeah. But it didn't really 5-6 years ago. So I already knew from watching Twitch that it was fun just to watch games, even if nobody was funny, because that is a thing, because Twitch. But telly didn't know that then. It's increasingly hard to credibly argue that telly isn't aware that that world and that platform exists, and yet it still maintains the reticence that it had several years ago, which if anything I would have thought that would have made it easier for me, but it certainly isn't. And you know, I'm the guy who made Go 8-Bit trying to create a new thing in that environment, and it is no easier getting another show away than it was getting great. But the only thing that's different is that now people are more inclined to defer to my judgment on the nature of the show, but it's not any easier to get it greenlit than it ever was, which is sad, but I really want to do it because it's fun.
And you think, you know, in terms of watching other people game, I mean, that kind of goes back to the arcades when you'd look at a good games player over the shoulder and, you know, it kind of goes back to the start of gaming, really, that people always enjoyed observing.
It's demonstrably a thing. I mean, this is why, like, I've been working quite a lot with ESL recently, and it's lovely because I came from the world of comedy and then made video gaming things. And so I've constantly, throughout my career, had to convince people games are entertaining, whereas working with an institution like ESL, it's lovely because the conversation has already begun from the fact that everyone in the room understands the inherent entertainment value of gaming. So then you can talk about how creatively you deliver that and what sort of things you might want to do for mischief or whatever. And it's lovely to, most of my time is taken up convincing people it'll be okay if we put games on a thing. And so it's been liberating to work with people where that difficult and all too often had conversation isn't required, so you can just focus on creatively making something fun. So I'm really enjoying working with people who get it.
Well, I did hear that you found out the show was being cancelled via Twitter.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
What happened
there? We'd had murmurings that maybe things weren't looking too good, but it was through... Bizarrely, somebody had tweeted the channel out, because people were always asking the channel, oh, when's it coming back? What's happening with Go 8-Bit? And for some reason, because they outsourced their social media stuff. So whatever third party they were paying to manage their channel took it upon themselves to categorically announce that Go 8-Bit had been canned, which actually wasn't and still isn't the case. But due to a poor briefing and an overreaching on behalf of some poor bugger who's probably getting paid 10 quid an hour to look at 30 different social media accounts. I was tagged into that and thus told in that way that the show was not coming back. But I'd already got a fair inkling that it wasn't. I was already beginning work on other things, but that was the red line. Although it's since turned out in the aftermath when I had subsequent conversations with higher up people involved that actually it wasn't as certain as that tweet made it look. But yeah, that was I was on holiday with my wife. It was a really fun way to find out.
Oh God.
Well, but talking of other things as well, you got involved in the Christmas lectures.
Yeah, that was off the back of Go 8-Bit, because when it was the same weekend we filmed the TV pilot for Go 8-Bit, we'd also got our residency across town, and me and Rob were adamant we were still going to do the residency, because that's how we made money, because the residencies sold tickets. And so we sort of shipped up all the kit from the dress rehearsal from the pilot, went across town, did a gig, then packed it all up and drove it back for the pilot the next day, which was a pain in the ass. But someone who was involved in the Christmas lectures happened to be at that gig and saw us doing this thing that we used to do in the live version of Go 8-Bit, where we would stick a comedian on a virtual reality roller coaster and make them hold a tray of champagne glasses while they rode around, just to try to sort of show how it messes with your head. And so they happened to be doing that year's Christmas lectures were about perception, and they wanted to use virtual reality. So then we met, I think it was Danielle, wasn't it? Danielle George was the professor that year. Met up with her, and they sort of got us on. So originally that should have been, I think we're even introducing it as Go 8-Bit, but it's just me and Rob because Sam wasn't available. And it was off the back of that that we then spoke to the Royal Institution about the technology Rob had developed with the smartphone gaming. And so that's how, because Wi-Fi Wars is residency, is at the Royal Institution. That's where we develop our new games. And then we're going to do our fifth annual lecture there in the summer program this year, which is insane. You know, it's the place where Faraday told everyone about electricity, and we go there and play Pong. it's
crazy.
A really clever version of Pong that Rob has made that no one else on the planet has managed to do. But nevertheless, it does. We were there on Friday. We were doing our debug night on Friday, and you do have to pinch yourself when you're walking in through Mayfair to go and do that in that place. It's an incredible honour to get to be involved with that place.
Yeah, however, people don't know what the Christmas lectures are. They're basically a set of lectures by the Royal Institute for children, and they kind of make science really good fun, but they're broadcast on the BBC, and I used to watch them every year. It kind of
they've been going for about 180 years, and it is, if you look at the list of people who've hosted the Christmas lectures, it is absurd. So to have actually been in one of those and been a part of that was, for me and Robbie were two massive nerds, was an incredible honour. And the fact that then we've, you know, continued that relationship for 5 years and it has become Wi-Fi Wars' home is, I'm very, very lucky that I get to do what I do. I constantly check myself for that. It's crazy.
Well, tell us about Wi-Fi Wars then, because that's a really cool concept.
It is, yeah, and again, I only say that because it's not mine. It's Rob. I just shout while we do it. But when Rob came to us in, it would have been September 2013, so very, very early on, he came to us and said, "Look, I've made this thing that I think you might like to use in the show because it's fun." And what he built was a version of Pong where the audience could log in through a sort of closed Wi-Fi network he stuck in the room and then go to a web page, and he would beam buttons into their phone through the web browser. So the audience could, as the ball was moving towards either the blue team's paddle or the red team's paddle, they press which direction they think it needs to go. And if the majority of the team pick the correct direction, it moves into place and hits the ball. So it's sort of a mass multiplayer playing a single game of Pong. And when he brought it to us, it worked with about six people. And we said, well, fine, you can try it out at our gig and we'll sort of, you know, we'll build it into the show as a, we've got this nerd who's trying to do a thing and made it a bit fun. The first time he did it, it didn't work. But he kept working on the code and bringing it back. And eventually that extended so that in our second Edinburgh show, 2014, the finale of the show was Pong. So we'd had comedians playing games through the show, but the final game, we handed over to the audience to let them all play the final game. Through this tech. And what we also did, which was a thing that went through at the TV show, was we allowed the audience to score points during the show by guessing who they thought was going to win in each round. So if they guessed correctly who was going to win in each game, they'd accumulate individual points, and as a result they could win the show. So that sort of the vote in Go 8-Bit is a hangover from that. We sort of lost the audience score element, and it just became a way of setting points. It sort of lost a little bit of the point of it in the transition to telly, but that voting mechanic was there from the very almost the very beginning as a way to allow the audience to effectively play the show. And then after we did the Christmas lectures at the Royal Institution, we couldn't believe we'd been at the Royal Institution and we wanted to go back. So we said, Rob's got this technology he's invented that lets an audience play the things. Could we come and give a talk about that? And they called our bluff and said, yes, you can have a lecture in the summer program about this amazing thing you've created. But at the time, all Rob had got was a vote and Pong, working with about 50 people. So Rob then had to retrospectively invent the technology we'd pretended he created so that we could give a lecture about it. So Rob had about 4 months to invent a suite of games and other toys using that tech that allowed us to do an hour-long lecture. And so in that first year, it was all button games. So just buttons in web pages. So it was 2 feet for a track and field, and you'd run left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right to run. Or there'd be a grid of 9 buttons to correspond to 9 whack-a-mole holes, and you'd play a game of whack-a-mole. And he got that working. So that worked with about 300 people. And then since then, he's developed it in lots of different ways. So we now, rather than have the game on the screen and they all play with the buttons, we can beam games into your phone. And that's everything from something like Space Invaders that you play on your phone and you score an individual score and collectively your team scores points, all the way up to VR using Google Cardboard or a 3D first-person shooter that they all deathmatch against each other. So really incredibly advanced stuff. He's got it working online now, so we can do it as an online show where people can watch on Twitch live and play all the games in the Twitch stream and win a game if they're the best. So we're doing that twice a week on our Twitch channel at the moment. And he can even make the venue compete against the people watching online, so we can have the studio audience compete against the world watching the live broadcast that we do.
It sounds fantastic, because like audience participation is usually like put your hand up or phone a friend or, you know, 50-50. It's not the huge gaming section.
No, it is staggering what he's achieved, and it fundamentally changes what you think of as sort of the benchmark for what interactivity is. And again, I say that because I can't take any credit for it. It is all that man.
You know, the best place to use that would be festivals where everybody's waiting for a gig. Yeah, play a
big
game.
Well, this is it. It's things like that. It's queues at fun fairs. It's any sort of place where there are people waiting around, because everybody's got the technology they need in their pocket, just ready to go.
Well, tell us about this new show that you've brought to the stage, the Video Game Game Show Show.
The Video Game Game Show Show, that's right. Well done. The Video Game Game Show Show is the culmination of all me and Rob's work, really. So obviously the Go 8-Bit was a show that we worked on for years. There's Wi-Fi Wars, which I've talked about. We do another thing called Pub Quiz, which is literally just a series of quiz rounds, but we get comedians to come up with the questions and sort of comedically host individual rounds. So sort of a mixed bill night. And what the video game show is it's a blend of all the toys and shenanigans that me and Robert developed over the last few years. So it is comedians competing on classic games. It is the audience voting on who they think is going to win. It's the audience playing some of those games. There are quiz rounds. There are stand-up or sketch comedy sets from comedians during the show. And so in every way that we like to entertain an audience playing with video games, the Video Game Game Show is our little place for that. And we just do it once every couple of months in London, purely, again, in the same way we did with Go 8-Bit. It was about going back to the spirit of that after everything we went through with getting Go 8-Bit on telly. So it's just once every couple of months, just in the basement of a pub near Oxford Circus, just get drunk, get a couple of funny people in and just play some games with whoever wants to come and join in. It's loads of fun.
But you also wrote a book as well, a retro gaming book. I mean, that nearly
killed me. Yeah, it comes out next month, finally. Yeah, don't ever write a book. Don't ever write a book. It's horrible.
Well, there's a lot of kind of retro gaming titles out there. And what kind of sets this book apart?
I've researched the hell out of it. I've read everything about retro games there is. There's not a book or a thing of note that I've not read to write that book. And as with Go 8-Bit, and I think it comes across in a lot of stuff, I really care about games and I'm passionate about them and their ability to sort of transform and inspire and all of those things. And I didn't want to just write a, ha ha ha, this is the funny thing that happened when I was 14 when I played a game, or cliched humour. So I was determined to write a legitimately comprehensive history of games, because there's not that many books about that properly cover the history of games anyway, but the ones that do, as I've now discovered, necessarily choose to limit their scope. So they might focus on consoles or arcades or the US scene or Japan, or they might focus on UK computing, but many of them, even if they do cover all those, they focus on one and allude to others. What I wanted to try to do was for that period of games, which is everything from the beginning until Ocarina of Time comes out, basically end of 1998. Yeah. I wanted to try to tell the history of all video and computer games. Obviously not every single game, but there were lots of different places where different things were happening on different platforms at different times. But if you dig for it, there are links and there are ways that things cross over, and people that began on, say, the demo scene in Europe when they was cracking games back in the early 80s, you find those guys drifting through to publishers who then eventually migrated from 16-bit computers to, say, 32-bit consoles. And it's about people, and it's about the individuals and the companies behind those games that are created. And I think I successfully managed to tell that story, and that's what I've tried to do. And that was hard in and of itself, because I had a very tough year personally last year. We had a lot of very difficult things happen to people close to us last year. So it was a very stressful year anyway. But the level of research I had to do to tell that story, I vastly underestimated the amount of work it was going to take. But I think I've done it. The people who've read it, that I've given it to, that I trust, like it. The thing that made it so hard was, not only did I have to do that, I then had to make it funny. Mm. Books are really big, so it was... If you choose to read it, which I hope you will, I hope you'll feel I achieved my goal. But it really is to, my hope for it would be, if in 10 years' time there are people that are studying game design or anything of that nature at a university, I'd like to think that my book would be the one they pick up if they want to get a good grounding in everything that happened up to that point, but in a more accessible, easy to read way. I think it's quite digestible because of the humour and the lightness that I've sort of tried to put across it. That is the lofty aspirations I have for that book, because I certainly really, really tried to make it that good.
And the thing about it is, I mean, you know, when you've got a book, it's written down, it's there in print forever, isn't it? It's not like a website article where you can change stuff if you get it wrong. So I imagine the pressure is on to research it to the nth degree.
Yeah, and there will be stuff wrong with it. I'm sure there'll be things wrong with it that if I do a second edition, I can tidy up, and I'm sure people will pick me up on bits and bobs where I've got inaccuracies or whatever. But I've done everything I can to make that not a thing. But certainly in the writing of it, like obviously I do a lot of live shows, and you know, you do a gig and then you might have had a bad gig, but it's gone. It just disappears into the ether. And even something like a TV show, it does exist, but most people aren't looking at it after it's been on. Whereas the permanency of a book is terrifying.
Isn't there, or was a copy in the British Library as well, if you actually get a proper published book. Yeah,
that is true. Yeah. It's an insane thing to have got to do. And also personally, it came at a very good time because we just finished filming Seriously of Go 8-Bit. So I was able to give myself fully to that sort of a new project while I tried to get the ball rolling on the next thing. So it came at the right time, but I wish I'd just written a load of stupid jokes about games. It's so much easier. So much easier.
Top 100 game-related jokes. Yeah,
you know what I mean? Christ, it nearly killed me. It was horrific. But I'm glad I did it, and I'm glad I worked that hard on it, because it is genuinely now a book that people I trust have liked it, and I think I've made a good thing. I'm fundamentally just a nerd who really likes games, and I really hope I've made a book that other people like me will enjoy, because I've put everything into that book.
Well, the book's called Hey Listen. Going to be out on the 18th of April.
Yep.
So people do want to get hold of it, and I'm sure it's going to be great.
Kindle and audiobook, read by me. If you're not sick of my voice yet, you can have another 12 hours of that.
Oh, I did an audiobook a couple of months ago. That's hard work in itself, isn't it?
That's tedious. Yeah, just locked in a slowly heating cupboard for 3 days.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it, but yeah, it's hard. You have to concentrate on saying things for ages.
Yeah, and got to say them properly.
Yeah, and they'll pick you up on it if you don't. And again, and again, and again.
I'm just waiting for the bit where Dan fell off his chair to see if that made the edit.
After I've listened back to the 15 hours.
Yeah. Oh, we did that because Dara couldn't record the forward, so because he was out of the country. So I got Sam in to record it instead, which was really, really nice. And there was a bit of mischief on the one that I think has gone in the audiobook, but we did also record a 15-minute long version of the forward where me and Sam just essentially character assassinate Dara for 15 minutes. I'm trying to convince the publisher to let us put that out as like a teaser thing. So you're talking about outtakes. That's the one. I hope you'll all get to hear that because it was brutal.
Fantastic. Well, Steve, I'll put a link in our show notes, to where people can buy the book and your podcast and everything as well.
Oh, thank you, man.
It's been a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for putting up with me just talking about myself for so long, like a massive egomaniac. It was a pleasure.
Really enjoyed it.
Cheers.